Mobile. Before CPA Mobile.
Got that AC on in that mobile, because I surely do. AE4BM Mobile.
Oh yeah. Got a little AC going, and I wish I was out on the tennis court playing some tennis.
David, 10-4-DJC.
How you doing, Jerry?
Dad, waiting on hopefully some rain this afternoon. Getting any up your way?
A whole lot of sunshine. There's some white clouds, around, but not anywhere near here, and they don't look very threatening.
Yeah, we got a little bit this morning, maybe 20 minutes for us, maybe at that much, but hopefully we'll get some more this afternoon. It's terribly dry here the last 2 or 3 weeks. You headed out to play?
Sitting at next to the roadhouse that waiting for him to bring out my to-go order. And I'm not gonna play any tennis today.
Good. We've been eating there off and on there pretty regularly. We hadn't eaten last week or so, but it's always good there. They don't open here. Well, they open here. It's 11:30 on Saturday and Sunday, but they open later during the week still. 3 o'clock, I think.
Jerry, I missed all of that. The lady walked up while you were talking. Sorry. And, but anyway. So, I guess you need to repeat that. Your last there. But anyway, go ahead.
And that's a good place to eat. We like going there. We haven't been there in a couple of weeks now, but stepping on early on Saturday and Sunday, we stayed up until 3 o'clock on Monday through Friday, I think. It's been pretty damn good, though. It's pretty consistent. And they'll probably go up, and they continue to go up in price, I guess, though, as something happens.
Like everything else, everything that we transport burns fuel, so, everything's gonna go up, but anyway, it's just the way it is, but, prices are coming down. I noticed that Walmart today here in Taylor's was like $3.36. So, or $3.30, maybe it was $3.38. Anyway, that's about the cheapest I've seen it lately.
It's like $3.40 something or $3.50. Like on Tuesday, it's come down since then, but. I mean, that's good, but I think it's lack of demand, and also, we're probably not going to see lower food prices out. You know, once they go up, they just never come down, it seems like.
It's supply and demand, I guess. If we'll pay the price, then why should they come down on it? this is the way it is. It's sad, but true.
Well, that's the way it is. You're right. The portion sizes get smaller and the price goes up, it seems. Been watching some of the packaging over the last 6 months, and some items are, the packaging says, just less weight in the packaging or stuff smaller, that sort of thing. They try to fill you and put it in a bigger, same size box, but less of it.
I'm sitting in the garage here, so I'm going to take take this food inside. It sure does smell good. And, yeah, they do the business over there at Roadhouse. They're always busy when they're open. But anyway, you have a good evening and the rest of the day, and we'll talk to you later. I'll clear out of here after your final KP4CPA.
Yeah, don't let that get cold. Get up inside and eat it. I can probably smell it from here. Have a good evening, Dave. Good talking to you. N4DJC, clear.
And Gerald TR. Oh, I just come downstairs, Jerry, and cleaning out a drawer here. And Bernice is shampooing a rug up there in one of the bedrooms. I've been out and fed and watered the chickens, and it's horrid out there. 95 degrees, 54% humidity, and 108 heat index. And I believe it. It's in Zero TR.
Great idea of cooking hamburgers at lunchtime today. It's kind of cloudy when I went outside. I got a little bit of shade in one area of the backyard where I generally grill out, but it got hot up. The sun, of course, came out about the time I got the grill out there, and it was terribly hot, but the humidity this afternoon, I stuck my nose out a few minutes ago, and the humidity is terrible. We got a little bit of rain this morning. I was telling David about maybe 20 minutes worth, but we haven't got any today. Since then, I'm hoping we're going to get some this evening because we sure do need it.
100s there yesterday, I think it was. we went over and ate at the Little Rebel a while ago, and I looked at the weather there. A guy I was talking to asked, and it said for Greer about 7 o'clock this evening, and then it's supposed to be general rainfall past midnight, so I hope they're right for once.
So too, because it's sure been avoiding us the last 10 days or so. That's the first rain this morning we've gotten probably in 10 days, I guess, and it wasn't enough to do anything. The grass just looks terrible, and I'm trying to still water pastures too here and there, but I just can't, I can't get out there, and I'm just not going to pay a $200 water bill to water my grass. I can't do that. That's just beyond my thriftiness, I guess.
I only watered about three times, or something like that, in the last month or so. And then we watered the garden some with those little sprinkler hoses for a couple hours at a time, which they don't let much through, but they do a pretty good job. And checked the straw today, and it was moist under it, and I don't know how. But now since we was over at the Rebel there a couple hours ago, they lowered the chances now from 70 down to 40 at 7 o'clock. 60 at 8 o'clock, 50 at 9, 50 at 10, and then 40 all the way through 3 a.m. And they're saying cloudy conditions from 5 to 7 with scattered thunderstorms expected at 7 p.m.
It's here in the last several hours, but that's probably about the same thing. I don't see anything coming up from the Atlanta area. At least I did yesterday, you know, where we get, you know, we have more rain from that direction than we do from the other direction. You just don't want to cross 85 when it comes down from up part of the state. But when it comes up from Georgia, sometimes just bypasses and hits around a star, and that way it just kind of splits up around Centerville, somewhere that area. But hopefully we'll get a little bit. But this morning you'll be interested. I was listening on D-Star on the reflector out of Atlanta, and I heard W9W on, and it was the Oshkosh air show, and it was Warbirds over America special event station. I think they were operating on 20 meters, too. But that was kind of interesting. They had a lot of contacts on D-Star. Of course, it's easy to do. You don't have to worry about band conditions, but I was listening to Ray Novak. Ray, he's their ICOM guy for the U.S. see today in terrible conditions up there. Couldn't get out on anything but 20, and even then they were having a time with it. They've been up there like 4 or 5 days, I think. Time, I think, to go back. I think it's over tomorrow, I believe.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. I used to belong to that Experimental Aircraft Association, and I get their magazine, and it ends tomorrow. We've been to it 3 times, and if you joined it, you got a discount when you went up there. It is phenomenal, but it's right out in the middle of the flatlands. When it's hot, it's extremely hot, and almost every time I ever went, it rained, and other than that, it was a wonderful show. Usually, it's like here. You step inside a big old pavilion and stay out of the rain, and when it's over, you go ahead and do your thing. Well, I'll look for that, Jerry. I hadn't seen it. There's a K7K, kilowatt, 7 kilowatt, up in the Aleutians at Kiska Island. It still discounts for Alaska, but it's been on and been pretty good conditions on it. I worked them on 17, and then I worked Austria and Puerto Rico, United Arab Emirates and Portugal, and Market Reef, and Charlie Tango 9. I think that's Madeira. Stroke Delta Lima 1 CW on 30. Then I jumped over to 40 and worked at Market Reef on 40. But boy, it was a stretch. I'll tell you, I could just barely hear him, but I did get him.
K7K, saw the info on that. That's an interesting expedition. I guess you call it the expedition. I saw something on the Dix Engineering. We sent out something on Facebook, I think, about it, and it's been, evidently it's not as hard to get as people thought it would be, I guess. Hopefully the conditions are better. But yeah, they've been having trouble with van conditions. It's a Oshkosh show, and you were talking about raining up there. They had a monsoon like the day before it started, I think. I mean, it just poured down rain, windy, blowing stuff everywhere, and it cleared up, I think, in time for the fly-in to start. And it's been, just hot, but, sunny and hot, since that bit of weather came through, as far as I could tell. He was showing some videos of them flying over. I always had interest in airplanes, although, other than doing a little flying here and there, just enough to get my feet wet, and being up a number of times over the years, I've always had an interest in it, although I never took it seriously enough to pursue it much further than just doing a little licensing and that sort of thing, and doing a little radio control stuff too.
It's a rich man's hobby anymore. Pay a lot of money to go up there and bore holes in the sky, and I can't imagine what fuel would cost. Dave mentioned fuel going down. Well, the only reason it's going down is Biden released the strategic reserves, which is not supposed to be touched, and he's trying to keep it down for the midterm elections so they won't lose their butt any worse than they're going to. But that's what that amounts to. It'll go right back up just as soon as that gets over with. They can fool some of the people some of the time, but not old Tom. I'm not buying it. But at any rate, that's the most wonderful air show in the world up there. I always love to go. We was there with Airbus A380, that monster passenger plane, the first one to come into the States, landed there. And the winds were such he couldn't land on the main runway, and he had to land on a short runway. And on the short runway, the crosswinds were still horrible. They were like getting up close to their maximum, between 30 and 40 mile an hour gusts. And Manish and I were standing right there beside the runway with a whole crowd of people. And When that old boy landed, the smoke rolled off them tires. He reversed them engines, and that rudder went full in the opposite direction because he crabbed the airplane in, you know, skidded it, basically, into the runway. And he put her down. It was pretty amazing. It was all full of test equipment, and there was only, I think, 24 or 26 people on it. So I didn't go up inside of it, but... oh, gosh almighty, to stand under that thing is, it's like standing under one of them Antonovs just about from Russia.
Some of these pilots are pretty damn good. One of my friends flew the North Carolina Air Guard, and he flew C-130s, and evidently he was a pretty good pilot. I think he stayed with them about 20 years before he retired, but he got a good pitching out of TV. He enjoyed flying. He said, they're slow, but they're it's not bad flying those things. But my brother-in-law had, you know, he had a private plane for years. He just got rid of his a couple of years ago. His eyesight got to where it wasn't as good as it should be. But he flew for a long time. He had it was a low wing, and I don't remember if it might have been a Piper of some type. I don't recall. And but he flew into Anderson multiple times, and I've had a friend of mine that from about 40 years ago. He had a Beechcraft Bonanza, a single Bonanza, and you know we flew in it multiple times. But gosh, time that daggum thing! That was a $400,000 airplane back in the 80s. It was just like you said, a rich man's hobby. And they got to the point where they wouldn't let them expense flying. Either they had to be, you know, if they went at a certain distance from airports, so I think that's the reason they got rid of his. He was using his for pleasure and for business, but he was putting enough money in it for him to keep maintaining it.
N0TR. Yeah, that's the Cadillac of singles. Steve, my nephew that flies 787s now, when he was taking his training, his mom worked at Beechcraft, so he could get a Beech, I think it was an A36 or something like that, all glass cockpit and everything. It was back probably in the 80s. Yeah, it had to be, because he went to work for American in 91. And so my dad and I got up a couple hundred bucks, and he flew over to Pittsburgh there and picked me up. And my brother got a cheap ticket into, he was in D.C., worked for the Military Personnel Command, and he'd got a new wife. And they flew into St. Louis, and Steve picked us up, or picked me up, and we flew over there and picked them up at St. Louis. And that thing was a hot rod now, and it was beautiful. And you know, like you say, it was a $300,000-$400,000 plane. And Jerry Beans, his mom worked there, and he was in the Beechcraft Flying Club, $34 an hour.
Like stealing.
Well, Bernice and I went up. I got a nice picture over the atomic power plant up here, the nuclear plant. I forget the name of it right now, the one that supplies Sierra Duke. And I got a nice picture out of it was a 172, and we flew over to Clemson and flew over the stadium and landed down there and then come back. My daughter's neighbor has a plane, and he's got a 182 now, and all glass cockpit and ADS-B and all the goodies on it. He flies over and visits his brother over in Texas in it now and then, but he's very well off, put it that way. But even at that, he's got $250,000 in that thing.
Only time I went to Dayton time, we flew up in one of my brother-in-law's friends. It was a Cessna, and I don't remember which one it was. It had a four-seater. But it was a really nice plane. He was an engineer. You know, he was just real particular about everything. I didn't worry about getting in a plane with him. But it was a nice flight up to Ohio. It was here at that time of year, you could see all the green fields. It was just one of the things I just seem to recall when flying up there, it was that green Ohio, which is like a little farm dotted all over the place. It just didn't look to be as populated as some other, you know, except when you got up there. If you got a little further north, I'm sure it was. You got around Cincinnati, maybe, but it just looked like farmland most. It was a really pretty state, and it was nice flying up there. I don't remember how long it took us, but we flew in up to Dayton and stayed, you know, for the like 3 or 4 days, and flew back, and it was really pretty comfortable. It got kind of warm on the ground, you know, while we were waiting to get out of whatever airport there is at Dayton, in the Dayton area. But after we got up in there, it was very comfortable, and a smooth flight too. And like I said, I don't know what it was. It might have been a step up from 172, but it was a nice plane.
A nice plane. There was 152s that flew in one of those out in Wichita with Steve, and we had some gusts that day, and I didn't feel a bit comfortable in it, and I flew off carriers, and I still didn't feel comfortable in it. It just, like the wind had you instead of the plane had the wind, you know. I remember we flew over all those Braniff airline planes that were out there parked at Boeing. I think it was. It had to be. And they were all lined up there, big jets, you know, and they were multicolored at that time. I remember that. But, yeah, I've been bounced around a lot, but we flew into here one night in a thunderstorm, and it got pretty dicey, I'll tell you. And I asked the pilot after he landed, I said, when'd you break out? And he says, 250 feet. God almighty. But Wyatt says they can essentially land clear down to zero if the ILS is working right and everything up here. It's a class 3 or something like that. And he works on that kind of thing. But, yeah, it's amazing what they can do. At these big airports now, they got all the best bells and whistles on them. Well, yeah, I loved Dayton. I'm trying to think of the airbase there now. And I keep wanting to think of Whiteman, and that's where the B-2s are. But that one there at Dayton, they had everything. Yeah, every kind of plane imaginable from day one on at that Air Force Museum.
That was really nice. The only time I've been in a small plane that I don't care to repeat was when my buddies up Rock Hill had a Tri-Pacer. You know, those things are not very big planes. And I wasn't real sure he was that good of a pilot, and I went up anyway. I think we flew around for about 20 minutes or so, and I was ready to come back down. So we sat back down, but he and one of my guys I worked with went somewhere. I think went to Myrtle Beach or somewhere. They wound up coming back, wound up having to land in a field somewhere. And I said, thank goodness I wasn't with them. Because I said, he just didn't appear to be pilot material.
I'm here. Yeah, you can tell, Jerry, that's for sure. And old Steve, the nephew, he was rigid about rules and regulations and that. I'll never forget when we was flying back to St. Louis, I said, why don't you just go above the clouds, Steve? I said, nobody's going to know it, you know. On the way, he said, oh, yes, it would, Tom. He says, no dice. He says, I'm not rated for IFR yet. And he says, when I am, we'll go above the clouds. I was just seeing if he'd break the rules. And, boy, he wouldn't. And he flew into St. Louis there. That's a big airport. And we landed at the International there at St. Louis. I guess it's international. It's huge. And he did a fine job. But that Bonanza is a great plane. I've flown in quite a few different little singles. I think the most fun I ever had is flying in one of those paragliders. And the guys that I knew were pilots out the airport back in our little town, they said, you're nuts to go up in one of them. But, heck, it was like riding in a rocking chair, Jerry.
See them occasionally flying across the lake down here, you know, when it's real calm, when there's not any, you know, turbulence, there's not any obstructing or anything like that, any lift going on. I've seen them fly bunches of times over the years. Not anything out here lately, but in the years gone by, I've seen them fly. And they're just kind of cruising across, maybe 15 miles an hour, maybe it's that much. They're not exactly moving very fast, but it looks like it's nice and easy. I guess if you run into a wind gust, it may be a problem. But probably the nicest small plane I've flown in was a Citation. That was a pretty nice twin. And I've flown in King Airs too, but I think it was a Citation. It was a twin Piper of some type, but it was nice. It was fast too. We flew to North Carolina and back. Well, we actually flew from Rome, Georgia to somewhere in North Carolina and back. And that plane was there. It was moving along pretty good. It got kind of turbulent with it too, but you know, they were flying pretty high. I don't remember the altitude, but the guy with us was a pilot too, and he said it's going to make it a little choppy here, but it was still a pretty nice ride there.
Kansas Cessna business jets, Jerry, and those King Airs. Wow, you know, I was out at the airport one day back there in Kansas, and I was talking to a guy that flew in for the company that I didn't work for at that time, but I did later at that wheel plant, and it was a King Air, and our service ceilings were like, oh, I'm going to say, it's been too many years here, I'm going to say, not much more than 24,000, and in the P3, and it had the same engines as the C-130. But they fly 320 knots, and I think that's about what the C-130 would. And you convert that into miles an hour, and it's getting up towards 400. Now, they didn't cruise at that, but that was their top speed. They were 4,600 shaft horsepower each. They were called T-56 Alphas at that time. But they were powerful little boogers, I'll tell you. This is 0TR.
And 40KC. When I flew, it must not have been a Citation. It was a twin prop. And I don't know why I thought Citation. I can't remember the name of it now. It's been well over 20 years ago. It seemed like it was a pipe. It could have been a Cessna of some type, but it was a twin prop. It wasn't a jet.
Yeah, that'd be possibly an Aztec. And I can't remember some of the other ones, Jerry. That was getting into the class of business type props, you know. There was another one that the company I first worked for, when I first got out of service, they had one, a real low slung thing. And it wasn't very famous for low lives. I can't remember the name of that thing. Made by Bombardier, I think. It was a twin. Atkinson Armature Works had it. But now the Piper Aztec was a nice twin.
But I'll have to check, remember, see if I remember. It was pretty loose one. It did remind me of a. It was. It did not remind me of a Cherokee twin or anything like that. It was a little airplane. This was a business plane. It was a private flight. We booked. We chartered to fly up a business thing and back. Somebody I thought was Citation, but that must not have been it. It was something else. Like I said, I don't remember now if it was Cessna or Piper. For some reason, I thought it was a Piper, but it might have been something else. But, I mean, we got on it in the dark and got off it in the dark. So, I don't recall exactly what it looked like now. But it did fly. I mean, it was a good flying plane. It was fast, too. And that's probably the nicest, smaller prop, twin prop I've been in. I used to fly on Piedmont years ago, time when it was all turbo props too, and I like flying on Piedmont stuff too.
Ever flew on Piedmont? Well, you was talking about visuals out there, windows and that. One of the most unusual things, the first time I ever saw it, is when we flew over, I think it was the west part of Colorado and on over New Mexico. It was over New Mexico, and they had those irrigation things that went in big circles, and it just looked like circles and circles and circles for miles. You ever see those, Jerry?
And right at the edge of New Mexico, and into Lubbock, Texas, and that area, flown to Panhandle, and flown down to San Angelo. I've flown all over Texas, and you know, puddle jumpers, I guess, small stuff, but this is all business. But yeah, I've seen this. It looks weird from there, doesn't it?
There could be water out there. And they're depleting the Rubidoux aquifer, I think they call it. But they are monstrous things. Well, I went in one of the roughest rides I ever had in a small one. I was sent to install some valves at the Navajo Indian Irrigation Reservation in Farmington, New Mexico. And when I went out of there, it was on a small Beechcraft Twin, and I wasn't too crazy about that. I flew in there on a DC-9 or something like that, or 737. Well, I believe it was Frontier, but when I went out, I went on that puddle jumper, and I seen it sitting there. I can't remember if I flew in or flew one of the jets into Durango, and when we went into Durango, I could see the dust kicking up down there around the runway as we circled the airport before we ever landed. And the old boy that was, I was sitting up near the front. It was a business trip, and I was sitting up near the front. As soon as we landed and they dropped that door, he looked as green as the carpet, and he ran out and puked right out there on the ladder.
Thankfully, I hadn't had anything. Haven't had anything quite like that. So, but I've had some interesting stuff from time to time. You know, drop 30 feet or something like you feel like something's going somewhere that shouldn't be. It's going in the wrong direction. But the I guess one of the most unusual things I was flying. I think I was flying from Lubbock back to Austin maybe or somewhere like that. And you can see a dust storm off in the distance there, about 80 miles away. It was clear, but man, it looked like something out of a science fiction movie. See a dust storm moving across the plains like that, and people just don't realize how flat that land is. You know, from the east until they get out there. I know we were in Littlefield. I was in Littlefield interviewing for a job, and you could see the street lights in Lubbock. It was about 36 miles away. And I said, man, he said, well, I said, you know, all the windows here are sealed. You can't roll the windows down because all the dust gets in. He said, you can leave your car outside during a dust storm. You gotta get it vacuumed out because all the dust is sitting in the seat and in the floorboards. And I thought, and they offered me a lot of money to go out there. And I said, I don't think so. I declined that job.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I went out to set some limit switches on the dams in San Angelo on this project that they were doing, which I don't know if they ever got going. It was held up either before I got there or after I got there because some kind of salamander that was a rare thing, and they'd already made them reroute that somehow, the river there, to make sure they didn't kill that a salamander or whatever it was, or a lizard. But I felt the same way about that place, Jerry. I was almost scared to get out of the car after we landed. Some old boy got bit by a rattlesnake, and they showed me some pictures of some of the rattlesnakes they killed out there. And they had them big construction trucks, like a big Ford or Dodge, you know, with four doors on them where they haul crews out. And they had one that he hung over the door handle, and he just dang near touched his tail and his head over the top of that door handle. And I thought, this just ain't for me. All there was cactus and sand.
Friends I was working with at the time, he'd already gone out there and accepted a job out there. This thing, let me switch to another way. This battery might be dead.
Roger, and Gerald GR.
Back down.
Yeah, Jerry. Yeah, I didn't care anything about San Angelo, and I had to drive a long ways out in the desert to get to the job site. And I definitely wouldn't want to work out there very long. The wind come up, and then the sand would just hurt when it hit you, you know.
The went out there from North Carolina before I went out there. Anyway, he called me up and said, you'll love it out here. He said, you worked all the time, and then you got, I think, 10 days off or something like that about every other month or something like that, or 2 weeks off. It had some kind of weird rotating shift. There's a dental weaving operation in the middle of nowhere. It's owned by the American Cotton Growers Association. And, of course, you couldn't get any people. You wouldn't think they had to import everybody from North Carolina, South Carolina. They didn't have anybody that area that knew how to operate the machinery, knew anything about weaving or, that sort of thing. And I went out there and I went out and talked to them about it, and they said they offered me a whole lot more money I was making. And I said, I can't see my wife and I living out there. If it was Austin or somewhere like that, you know, in the hill country, it'd be a little different. But that was 4 hours about nowhere. I said, no, thank you.
What was you doing then, Jerry?
The superintendent of weaving, this was back in the 70s, late 70s, that's 77 or so. I started out working at Milliken. I started out weaving there. That's what I was in basically to the last 15 years of my career, and I've got into buying and selling equipment, that sort of thing. But I was a manufacturing management guy. But so, they were weaving for Levi Strauss and, dinner for Levi Strauss and Wrangler and people like that. And the American Cotton Growers, they just had a cooperative there. So they got the best cotton, but they just couldn't get anybody to work out there because it was in the middle of nowhere, and plus it wasn't a pool of talent out there either.
This is NGLT. Yeah, I can understand why. I'm surprised that there was a weaving place out there. We had a place that made all those famous jeans up in Fort Scott, Kansas. I remember going by that place a lot, but I never did apply to work there. I was working at a printing plant for a short time and got offered another job and quit and went there. But there wasn't a whole lot of that around there, but Corbury sure did a lot of it, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I worked for Springs for about 16, 17 years, I guess. And we moved down here back in 92. And I worked for them another few years here. And then I got into sales. And I traveled for the last 15 years I worked. But manufacturing, it's a tough life. You know, seven days a week, 24 hours a day shifts. And when I left Springs, I had about 350 people working for me at the time. And it was just something all the time. And when I got in sales, somebody called me, it usually wasn't a problem if somebody wanted to buy something and I didn't have to work on the weekends either, so it was refreshing for me. I felt like I was on vacation the last 15 years I worked.
People working under you. Oh, I never did have that. Just a few that I could tell what to do now and then, but it was, maintenance was the same way. I was on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for my first 32 years there at that machine shop and structural plant. And but the good thing was you never knew what was going to be there to meet you every day, and it kept the job interesting. And I think that's a lot of what counts. If you like what you're doing, I look back on it now and just thank the good Lord I wasn't burned or anything working on high voltage, because most everybody I worked with was or had been, and had a couple of close calls, but never did get electrocuted, thank God. But it was fun because it was something not very many people knew anything about, you know.
Second time, I got to run out and bring my grill in real quick. It's starting to rain, believe it or not, here. I'll be back in just a minute. M4DJC.
Come get me a ginger ale. Ginger ale, TR.
TR, M4DJC.
TR. That worked out good, Jerry. I just went over and got me a good, cold, miniature can of ginger ale. Boy, those things are just 7.5 ounces. And we bought some at Walmart the other day. And they used to be $2.49 for six of them. I don't like to get a big can. It's too much sweet, you know. I like these small cans. And when we went in there the other day, there was $4.28 for the same six cans.
About $3 for six of them. That's the same thing I get. See, I get the, I want to say Seagram's or Schweppes, one or the other. I don't know which one, but it's 7.5 inch. The 7.5 ounce cans, that's the same thing I do. That's about all the sugar I have, you know, other than ice cream. You know, I eat a little bit of ice cream, too, but as far as soft drinks and stuff, I do the same thing with beer, too. If I can find one of those 16-ounce beers that's got a screw cap on it, I'll pour half a 16-ounce out into a glass and have a little bit of beer like that. But I just don't drink a lot of soft drinks anymore like I used to. I may drink one a week, maybe, or something like that. But those little 7.5 ounces are just right.
Calories, which is good. Now, Bernice says, oh, yeah, but how many carbs are there? I don't know anything about that. And I never have, and I don't care. It tastes good, and that's the bottom line.
Don't drink much carbonated stuff anymore, but the ginger, my grandson likes them too. He'll drink one. That's about right size for him, too. He doesn't want a big one either, so he'll tell you. He'll grab one of 7.5 ounces.
Well, I just went on QRZ, and as you look down the side there, if you see internationals talking to internationals, you can pretty well figure there's not very much propagation on this side, or somebody would be posting it, and I don't see it. It was pretty good last night, though. But this old computer, I use it a lot when I'm operating on HF and log my contacts and that and send them up to Logbook of the World. But if you leave it set idle very long, the screen will go black on it. I don't know what causes that, but Ariel, my 4G, put a SD card on here and said that all my contacts would go down to that from that logging program I got. But and he said you could take that and take them upstairs and put it into my new computer. I don't know how to do that, Jerry. And Dave, DJW, said he was going to come over and fix it where they could talk to each other, but he's busy and I hate to nag him about it, and so I haven't bothered him with it. But that sure would be nice to be able to log them down here and have it automatically, wirelessly go up to the other new computer.
I guess he's talking about having it on a local area network and being able to do it. I'm not sure how to do it either time. I know just enough. I've been fooling with computers for years, but I'm not a programmer. I'm just a user. And I tend to keep my computers a long time. I don't, you know, I mean, I've got a new one. Bought a new one last, I guess, in 2020, but I tend to keep my computers 8 or 10 years until they get thoroughly outdated. But the last couple I bought Apple Macs, and been real happy with them. But my oldest one is about 7 years old, and I can run Windows on it with setting up a virtual machine on it. And I use that for my radio programming software, and that's really the only thing I will use Windows for. I don't use it for anything else. But it works well enough on that to program the radios and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I got this TS-590SG, Jerry, and it's a wonderful radio, and I don't really need to change. But it doesn't have, you have to have an IF connection on it to drive directly over to a screen to display a band scope. And it doesn't have that. There is a way you can modify it if you go internally in that, but I'm not going to do that. So I have what they call a dongle, and I got it from ND7J. And then my friend Bill, N4IQ, come up and got the band scope set up for me, and You got to be awfully darn smart to do that, all that stuff he had to do. And it's been great. He'd only goofed up one time. It was just one little setting. And it's really handy if you got an operator operating split. Just like that K7K, he's on several of the band. I noticed he was not operating split, and some of them he was. And it's just it's like trying to talk on sideband in a pileup. And I'll work that if it's split, because I can look at it on the band scope and put the bandwidth such that I can see where the guys on split are getting them. You listen for their response, and I can home in on that pretty quick, and then see if I got the propagation, of course, and do a pretty, a real good job on it, put it that way. I have a lot of fun with it, because I usually get the contact. I might sit there for 15 minutes trying to figure out the split, but when I transmit, generally speaking, I'll get them on the first, second, third try. And I know sitting up there on that Kenwood 140 in Kansas, trying to get Heard Island in on the split with 100 watts, man, you might sit there for several hours before you got into places like that. And I just won't do that if it's on sideband anymore. It's just not worth it to me. So I stick pretty much to the CW. It's fun, and it takes a bit of skill, and you just don't have to sit there and holler your lungs out, you know. It's N0TR.
JC, yeah, you know, I know Bill got a 590. I think he might have got one from you. There's another guy I was listening to last night on the Anderson Club repeater that had, he lives in Harlow, lives in Cannon, which is just down the road from Harlow. And he's got a 590 as well. But I don't know if he's got an S or an SQ. I don't remember now, but he was telling me how well he liked it. And it's those are really good radios. I think if I had an inclination to do HF, and, you know, the thing is, sometimes I just don't think with the antenna situation, I think it wouldn't be worthwhile, and I would not nowadays. I just assume, you know, if I'm going to do something like that, I don't want to get an amp and have enough room for a full-size antenna of some type, because otherwise you really kind of picking here and there. And if you need to have, you need to have at least four. I mean, I know I worked a lot of stations QRP when the bands were really good, but when the bands aren't good, you got to have, you know, you got to have some, you know, you got to have 500, 800 amp to a decent, you know, full-size antenna of some type to be successful. And sitting there straining the radio for hours, it just ain't much fun.
Gary, I went 19 years without an amp. I just didn't have the money for it, and did really well with that 140 Kenwood. I love that radio. I sold it to the guy over here at the Catholic radio station. He had one at home, and he wanted to run it on the mobile, and they did that back in the old days. And it really done me well. I had a ball with that radio. Always got good audio reports on Kenwood gear, always. And this TS590ST's outstanding. It really is. I wouldn't mind having the 890 if I, you know, if this band scope or this computer screws up. But you're talking $4,000. And it's just not necessary. This one works just as good as that one, as far as I'm concerned. And yes, I sold that to Bill down there in 4WHM because he's a great guy and gentleman. And it was just sitting here. And I only used that thing, oh gosh, Bill could tell you, he had the papers on it for like a year or a year and a half. Not very long. And they come out with this SG, and I wanted it. So I got it. And I'd fire that one up every 30 days and let it run for an hour or so. And then shut it off and cover it up. And I just wanted somebody good to have it. And I feel like somebody good got it.
that he is a good guy. It's, like I said, I don't know Bill other than the radio because he's a little bit younger than I am, but his wife and her two sisters, we all kind of grew up together. Their mother worked in the bank with my mother, and their dad and my dad knew each other real well. We were friends and went to church together and went to high school together, all that sort of thing. So I know if Bill's a good guy. And I ain't heard him on lately. I've been meaning to try to catch him on sometime on the Harwell, the Elberton repeater over there, but I don't ever hear him on. I'm sure he's got a dozen other things going on. But that 140, though, Tom, I remember, I was thinking I had a 140, but I was looking back in my, when I was talking to you a while back, I was looking in my original log book from back in the late 70s, and I had a 120S, not a 140. And I think that might have been the first solid-state rig I owned. I think I had maybe a 520 maybe. They either had a 520 or a AC-101 ZD before then. And I think, of course, those two just had P-246B finals, I guess, in it. But the TS-120S was the first solid-state rig. I love that. I think the power supply is about, the Kenwood power supply is about bigger than the radio, I think.
An old L4B that I rebuilt, it was a wreck when I got it, and I did everything to it, and I had about $800 in it, and I sold it to Matt for $700, and he just loves it. Those were great amplifiers, but I wanted a solid state, and in my lifetime, I'd never dreamed of having such a thing, and I got the ALS-1300, and I bought the automatic band switcher for it, Jerry, and it's just a dream. It really is. I like it because one of the things, the workmanship in it, that's the first thing I did is take the lid off and look. The solder joints and everything on them are a lot better than, you know, it's an Ameritron, than in the old days at times. Surprisingly, with these China products out there, but the MOS transistors are separate in there, and if one of them blows, it's like, oh, $125, and they'll replace it. And a lot of the other type of amps, it'll all be built on one subtrait, shall we call it, and if you lose one, well, they got to replace all of them, and that can get a bit expensive, but there's no waiting for it to warm up. There's no tuning and all that. I just push the button there, and within about 3 seconds, it's tuned. And it's band switched. And, oh, man, that just makes it lickety-split.
That little 120, you can just power that thing on instantly and tune it up and be ready to get it. I work mostly CW for that. I've worked very little sideband over the years. The only sideband I did to match anything was 2 meter when I was doing that for a short period of time. But I worked CW person all the time. That's all I worked. That's what I was one of those guys that had to have a novice. You had to have a novice then, and you had to upgrade in a certain period of time. And when I went through, after I went through all that process, I got to where I enjoyed CW. And used it. The only time I worked anything for voice was just FM repeaters like I do now, but very little sideband. But I can always, you know, work through. I made a lot of contacts on CW. It was a lot of fun, and I got to where I could copy and send pretty well. And I got my 20 word per minute endorsement, but I had not passed advanced and not passed the extra exam. And I wish now I'd at least pass advanced, could have changed my call. And, of course, later on, I might have been able to get a 1x2 or a 2x1 call.
Ever take the advanced or the extra, Jerry? Is that what you're saying?
About the time I was doing that, I got a big promotion, and I got even more responsibility, and just got to the point where I couldn't. I mean, it just work all the time, and it just about, you know, about cost me my health. I worked 65 hours a week, and I didn't have time. That was about the time when I kind of let radio go by the wayside, and I still stayed in it, but I just didn't, the HF stuff just went by the wayside, and we moved a couple of times too. Just never set up a tower or antenna to mount anything or anything like that. And that was about 91, I guess, somewhere in there, 90 or 91. I just didn't do it. I wish I'd done it. I had to, you know, we had to learn to, you know, there's a difference, and, you know, no disrespect to anybody that doesn't do this, but, you know, we have to learn the theory instead of a question pool. It is different. Once you learn the theory, then you can move on to other parts. You know, and you're just not memorizing things. You're learning stuff, and that's the guy that started me out. He was an old electronics guy, and, you know, been back in the 40s and stuff, and he taught me a lot of stuff that I learned. Of course, it doesn't apply to anything nowadays because everything's all solid-state stuff. The theory is still there. The theory is still the same. And I think I learned a lot. And I think I'm sure I could have passed advanced to spend a little bit of time at it, and probably the extra, too, I guess.